We have a full house here in the Political Rewind studio this afternoon. We've gathered a panel of insiders to talk about, among other things, President Trump's ongoing trip so far to Saudi Arabia over the weekend. Israel, as of this morning, moves on to the Vatican and then to a big NATO conference. Greg Bluestein, a political reporter, the political reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, joins us. Greg, it's always great to have you. And on Monday.
Yeah, glad to be here on Monday.
Jim Galloway continues his vacation in Scotland. Some of you have responded to the fact that last week, Friday, he was listening to the show from Scotland, was at Loch Ness, and claimed to have seen Robert Mueller rise out of the lake.
He is also emailing me at 3 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, of course he is. He'll be back next week. Brian Robinson, a Republican strategist, who is a Monday regular here. It's great to have you back, Brian.
Look forward to Mondays all weekend long.
Dove Wilker is the title executive director?
A regional director.
Oh, regional director of the Atlanta Jewish Committee here in the Southeast. What are your states?
Georgia, North, South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee.
Okay, well, welcome. We're glad to have you here. And Syed Nassim, who is a Naim, who is, what do we want to say? You're a senior lecturer at Georgia State University, but you're also...
Well, I just got made principal senior lecturer, for what that's worth.
Congratulations. But you're also part of the Middle Eastern Studies Institute at Georgia State University. Right. And very active in the Islamic Speakers Bureau, which is a really wonderful organization that helps try to educate non-Muslims about Islam across the region. All right, everybody, a lot to talk about. I want to, before we get into, though, the conversation, give you a few news headlines. We should start with some local news. Greg Bluestein, you report in the Political Insider blog that the Vice President of the United States is going to come and campaign for Karen Handel in the 6th District race. When do we expect him?
June 9th, which is a couple Fridays from now. It is not a surprise. She has targeted Mike Pence since April 18th, really, to come down as someone, as yet another high-profile Republican official who can help her raise money and rally her supporters. He'll be here just a few days before the big vote.
Yeah, good timing for Karen Handel. He will not get the same treatment in the whatever rally they have that the vice president got as the commencement speaker at Notre Dame on Saturday, where dozens of graduating seniors walked out of the commencement exercise, or actually it was Sunday, to protest the speech that Mike Pence was giving. He had warned graduates against suppressing free speech, and I guess he got just what he wanted on that. So he'll be down here, and that's going to be a big deal for Karen Handel. Big news from Washington this morning. Mike Flynn has now said he will not comply with a Senate Intelligence Committee subpoena to give documents or to testify in the investigation of interference with Russia. He is going to plead the Fifth Amendment, and we're going to have to watch how that story unfolds. I'm not a lawyer. We don't have any lawyers at the table. Brian, I'm not sure what happens when you plead the Fifth in terms of turning over documents and that sort of thing. It's clearly leverage to try to get immunity, I think, would probably be the case.
But immunity from what? That's what I, you know, if the storyline is that we haven't committed a crime, it's really undermined when you take the Fifth. I think you just shutting up probably is one of the best strategies that could have been done throughout the Trump administration as this thing has unfolded, and that has not been the strategy that they have taken. But look, Flynn's going to get in trouble of some sort. I think there's enough smoke there. Yeah. There's some fire. And at the end of the day, the administration is going to roll him under the bus if they can, as they should, in my opinion.
Okay. well, we'll watch. That's an important story and a big development today. Finally, just before we get into our conversation, this comes out of the file of With Friends Like These. We recall that just a week ago, President Trump welcomed the president of Turkey, President Erdogan, to come to the White House. He praised him as a strong leader. He wants to cooperate with Turkey in every way that he can, despite the fact that we know that Erdogan is a strong man who has suppressed human rights in his country. And you will recall that there was a really unpleasant incident outside the home of the Turkish ambassador where protesters, who by all accounts were there peacefully, were attacked by Erdogan's bodyguards. And it's all on video. There were at least 9 people roughed up badly. And the president has been urged to make a statement about this is unacceptable behavior. But now the punchline. Turkey has now called the U.S. ambassador to Turkey in to formally protest the fact that he was not protected, the president was not protected properly by U.S. law enforcement, and they want an official apology from the United States government. You know, Greg, this is one of those times when you say, Mr. President, be a little careful about the friends you pick.
And it's one of many sort of, you know, strong-armed sort of leaders, I don't know if you call them dictators or what, that Trump is moving closer to in the Duterte in Philippines. There's some other strong-arm leaders who Trump has cozied up to.
Yeah. All right. So those are just a few of the news headlines for right now.
Look, this is absolutely outrageous that those people were attacked for peacefully protesting in our country. It is absolutely unacceptable. And I was really proud to see the local response there of going after those bodyguards. I wish we'd seen a few more heads bashed in of people in suits because they had it coming. This is absolutely outrageous.
All right. Anybody else want to jump in on this before we move on? Okay. I want to give you one program note. I've mentioned it once before, but this is my last chance to say it on the air. If you are interested in the future of Atlanta as a growing, prospering city, tomorrow night at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library, we're going to be recording a two-way street in front of a live audience. Our guest is Mark Pendergrast. He's written a book called City on the Verge, in which he argues that Atlanta very well might be the template for how American cities can revitalize themselves, or Atlanta could be headed right over the cliff. And he argues both sides of that. It's, I think, a really interesting conversation in the Atlanta Constitution this morning. Front page story about the fact that affordable housing on the Beltline continues to be an issue and that leaders are looking for a way to resolve that. This is just one of the kinds of things we're going to talk about. So if you want to join, we'd love to have you in the audience. 7 o'clock tomorrow night, Carter Presidential Library. It's free. Get there a little early so you can get a seat, make sure there are enough seats.
And one of the things Pendergrast is worried about is, does the Beltline become a yuppie boulevard?
Right.
Does it just become, you know, a very expensive place for young urban millennials to live, or does it become a place where anyone can afford to live near it?
That's right.
Well, you know, in contrast, there's another front page story in the AJC today talking about a surplus of affordable housing in rural Georgia. So, you know, they cover everything that they're on the front page
right.
today.
Dixie well, like the do. Yeah.
Well, Jenny and Lisa and Tyler and I will all be there tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. If you're not interested in the topic, just come out to meet us. We'd love to meet you. So we'd love to see you there. You can tweet us during the conversation today at PoliticsGPB to join the conversation. All right. Having made all those announcements, let's get right to it. Greg, the president landed in Israel this afternoon. There's some interesting aspects of this visit that we talked about briefly before the show went on the air. There are several firsts to the Trump visit, right?
Yeah, this is the earliest time a sitting president has ever visited Israel. Jimmy Carter even visited his third year. Obama didn't visit till his second term. Bill Clinton, I think it was his second year. So this is the earliest visit for a president, sitting president ever to Israel. It's also the first, I think they described it as an open direct flight from Saudi Arabia to Israel, which is another interesting
thing. Dove, what are the implications of that? What is it? Why is it significant that this is the first time that we've seen a flight from Riyadh in Saudi Arabia directly into, I think they must have flown into Tel Aviv, I assume.
Yeah, they flew to Ben-Gurion. Yeah. I mean, you know, it talks about the greater relationship between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Obviously, up until today, I mean, the Arab countries that surround Israel didn't give flight plans that allowed Israeli any plane to fly between the two countries. So it talks a lot about the growing relationship between the countries, the possibility for peace between Israel and its Arab neighbors, and also the the unified strategy that they all feel is very important in combating Iran in the middle and ISIS in the region.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about what emphasis the president put on dealing with Iran in a little while. But before, well, let's talk about the Israeli aspect of this visit for a couple minutes, because once today he's been with Netanyahu a great deal, visited the Western Wall. Lots of things on the agenda. But tomorrow he's supposedly going to visit with Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority. That's a significant event, yes?
Yes, it is. I think that what he's trying to do is to set himself up as somebody who can push the peace process forward. And probably we still don't know what the actual plan is, if there is one. But this seems to be an attempt to show that, look, we are even-handed and we can speak for both sides and get you somewhere in the middle where we can get some kind of an agreement.
Boy, he set himself a very high bar on this, and we'll talk about that. But Brian, just about an hour and a half ago, the president made some news without meaning to. There has been, he's been very on script during this visit, but there was a photo op during his conversation with Netanyahu, and as the photographers, video cameras were packing up to leave the room, the president stopped them to make a comment that relates to the story about his giving top secret intelligence to the Russians that could easily be traced back to Israel. That, of course, has been hanging like a cloud over this entire visit. And although there is a recording of it, it's not good enough to play it right now. You won't understand what he says. But what the president says is, wait, I didn't talk about I didn't say it was Israel to the Russians. I never said Israel, standing next to the prime minister, therefore telling everyone it was Israel and I admit it.
Yeah, you know, this.
I know I'm springing this on you.
Again, why keep going back to bad stories? And he does it. He keeps bringing back into the news cycle stuff that the administration doesn't want to be talking about. He has had what has been, for him, a fairly successful 2 days of media coverage where he looks statesmanlike, seemed to be a pretty savvy dancer there in the salty sword dance, you know. But he's got economic deals. He looks diplomatic. He looks like he's interested in peace. All of the things that we want the American president to do, and then he's got to go and re-enter the fray. He can't leave well enough alone. He can't be happy with winning.
Yeah, right, apparently. And we're going to hear a lot more about that story. It was an unfortunate moment for the president. Dove, why is his going to the Western Wall, first of all, significant? He's the first sitting president to visit the Western Wall. Maybe you should make sure everybody knows just why is the Western Wall significant in and of itself?
Yeah, so for the State of Israel, for Jewish people around the world, the Western Wall is actually the retaining wall from the Second Temple. So it's the holiest site within Judaism.
Destroyed in 70 AD, right?
70 AD, correct.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
By the Romans. So when Israel, during the Six-Day War in 67, when Israel reconquered Jerusalem, the Western Wall was essentially a housing plaza, and it's the closest spot to the Holy of Holies within Judaism. So it's the closest spot that you can be to where the sacrifices used to take place. Which happened in the temple.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah. And the Temple Mount is also home to the third holiest site within Islam and home to two different mosques. And so the relationship that Israel has to the Western Wall is being a part of Jerusalem, Israel's capital, the eternal capital of the Jewish people, the sign of a sitting president going and visiting the wall is something very important and shows a relationship and support for Israel and solidarity with the Jewish people.
Yeah, but Greg, there was controversy surrounding this too, because in the run-up to the trip, there an American official, to the best of my knowledge, still unidentified, told the Israelis that they weren't sure about a visit to the Western Wall because, you know, the Western Wall is in occupied territory. It's not in Israel. And by that he meant Israel did capture Jerusalem in the 67 war. But its ownership is in great doubt. And apparently you have an American official saying, well, maybe it's not Israel.
Yeah, and the future of that entire landmass is also in question. Will there be an international community presiding over Jerusalem if Palestinians ever get a separate state? So there's a lot of prickly issues there. And also there were reports that Netanyahu ordered his ministers to show up to meet Trump because there was talks about them boycotting Trump's visit. So there's a lot of uneasiness on the Israeli side that we're seeing a little bit of today.
What's interesting is the Dome of the Rock does sit right above the Western Wall. If you stand at the Western Wall, you look up and see this holy site of Islam. I was a little surprised, given his outreach yesterday to Islam, that the president didn't in some way make any reference of any sort to the fact that he was not only in front of the wall, I get the politics of that, but to look up and say, oh, this is a holy site for, you know, I'm trying to bring everybody together. Here's an incredibly important site for Muslims, too.
Yes, but were we expecting that?
Well, I mean, yesterday we heard him in Riyadh say, we're all one people. We all worship the same God. So I just thought maybe he might reference it.
He didn't use the phrase Islamic terrorism, right? Yeah. He softened some of his terms.
He used Islamic, but it was supposed to be Islamist.
It was actually, I think there were several things about the Saudi thing, if we can talk about that for a little while.
Go ahead. We're going to go back and forth. It's fine.
I thought that it went a lot better than a lot of people thought it would because there was a lot of apprehension about that. And so we, as was already pointed out, he didn't use the term radical Islamic terrorism. But he did slip at one point, but apparently they apologized for that. And I think this is primarily because he stuck to the script. I mean, he was reading off the teleprompter. I don't think he said anything. The second thing about his speech, which I thought was really interesting, was that he acknowledged or he said that the overwhelming majority of people who are victims of terrorism by these so-called Islamic groups or Islamist groups are Muslims, which I thought was very interesting.
I'll tell you, we have set the table for a really full discussion about some of the politics of all this, and there was some interesting policy differences between certainly President Trump and President Obama that we should talk about. But let's do this. Let's get our first break of the show out of the way. But as we go to the break, Dove, when we talked about this first flight from Riyadh to Tel Aviv, I think you need to tell us the post that you read about just that.
I saw someone on Facebook say, well, it was the first airline flight, but as you know, Mohammed went from Saudi Arabia to Jerusalem previously, so it's not technically the first flight.
All right. Political Rewind with more laughs in just a moment.
Take your spring cleaning to the next level by donating your car, truck, or van to GPB. We'll take care of everything, including free pickup, and send you the paperwork for your tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Back on Political Rewind, Brian Robinson, let me turn to you, if I may. Well, let's do this. Let's listen to a little bit of what Trump said. This was kind of the high point for many people. The speech that he was going to give to Gulf state leaders in Riyadh was highly anticipated, and many people were just scared to death about whether he might go off script or whatever, and he didn't. He actually gave a speech that many people today are saying, for all of the anti-Muslim rhetoric that he's espoused for 2+ years, Syed, he reached out to Muslims and said, we're going to work with you, we respect you. I'm not sure that that's going to change the overall dynamic, but that's an important moment, yes?
I definitely think it was an important moment, though I think it was very interesting that while he was saying this, he was at the same time talking about what he saw as the way to deal with this problem of terrorism in the region. And he was talking primarily in terms of a military solution. And he was talking to, he was not addressing the fact that there are underlying factors which lead to this. Essentially, the lack of dignity and opportunity in most of that region. And the people responsible for the lack of dignity and opportunity were sitting there in the room, and I thought that was kind of ironic. This contrasts a great deal with Obama's speech in Egypt, where he essentially said the same thing, except that he was addressing the common people in Egypt and the wider Arab and Muslim world, as opposed to 50 heads of state who had been invited for that purpose.
Yeah, Brian, if there's been any criticism of the speech, it's exactly that. He literally said, we're not going to play this portion of the speech, but he literally said, we are not here to lecture you. We're not here to tell you how to live your lives, which seemed clearly to be a statement that the old days of Obama talking about human rights, that sort of thing, are behind us. You have to fix your problems if they are problems yourselves. Yeah?
Yeah, and, you know, look, we need, this is a return to our traditional allies, our traditional alignments in the Middle East with Israel and with Saudi Arabia and lining up against Iran. You know, it was in Saudi Arabia, which has a terrible human rights record, which treats its women as third-class citizens. I don't think you can even be second-class if you're not allowed to drive. You can't show your face anywhere. But we used that platform to talk about human rights abuses in Iran. So it was a statement of American values, but it's saying on the one hand, we're going to overlook what our allies do, but we're going to continue to tisk-tisk what our enemies do. And I think it sort of undermines a little bit of that argument. That said, I think the real politic of it is smart. I think it's good strategy. At the end of the day, it's more important now for America to have a strong ally that provides us with energy that we need as opposed to focusing on human rights. I think that's something that's going to have to be done over time.
All right, but Dov, did you want to weigh in on that just quickly?
Just a short observation.
Sure.
You know, you talk about the women, and I agree with you about the human rights issues, and that's one of the big differences between Trump's administration and the Obama administration. But the photos from within the palace, there were a lot of women, actually, who did not have their heads covered. And actually, if you look at the official photo, there's a woman, it must have been the translator, who was sitting. It was President Trump, a woman and whose head was not covered, and the king of Saudi Arabia. And so one of the things that we are seeing actually is almost the influence and also a pledge of investment to for women's issues in Saudi Arabia is almost this ability to invest and help perhaps change policies within Saudi Arabia by not calling them out. It's an interesting contrast.
Well, the present king actually has laid out a very ambitious program in terms of the changing the status of women in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, King Salman is all for it.
He has. And whether he's able to do it fast enough or not is a separate issue, or whether this is just talk or he's actually going to do it.
Yeah, we don't know.
We don't know, but yeah.
Greg, I think there was but here's something really interesting, and I want you all to weigh in on this. I'm not sure we all recognize immediately, because you spend some time looking at the Middle East, and this takes a little longer to deal with. Yesterday, President Trump talked about enlisting the Saudi government in the effort to create a solution to the Arab-Israeli. He wants a two-state solution. All right. Oh, that sounds fine. But that puts pressure on Netanyahu, right? Because Netanyahu and the Israeli government have had a very interesting way of parsing all this. They want to develop relationships with Sunni Arabs like the Saudis without having to make that part of a Palestinian-Israeli settlement of any sort. And the president, by doing what he did yesterday, kind of puts Netanyahu on notice, we're going to bring everybody together. That's fascinating.
I think it's safe to say Israel sees Iran as the ultimate, is its number one enemy, even above ISIS and some other threats out there. I mean, after all, Iran through Hezbollah has declared war on Israel twice now. So they see Iran as a much bigger, clear and present danger than ISIS. And I think that they worry if there's a vacuum in Syria that Hezbollah would fill it, because they already have thousands of fighters in Syria helping ISIS. Netanyahu's always seen this anti-Arab coalition of Gulf states as a way to kind of also make the peace deal a subordinate deal. And the New York Times picked up today on an added line in Trump's speech where he thanked King Salman and said something about how much King Salman wants there to be peace with between Palestine and Israel. And their takeaway was, if Israel really wants peace with its Arab neighbors, the cost will be resolving the generations-old standoff with the Palestinians.
Exactly, exactly. He's, yeah, go ahead. Don't.
Well, I mean, it's one of the interesting things, and I know that Obama tried to tie that as well to Israel's peace with the Sunni Arab states. You know, but prior to the trip, when the president was talking about it, they were discussing the possibility of relationship, of peace between Israel and the Sunni Arab states. And it wasn't so much contingent upon peace with the Palestinians, but rather a settlement freeze. And it wasn't even a full settlement freeze. It was a partial settlement freeze. So I think the under-the-table conversations that they've been having is obviously coming much more to the fore. But it's also showing that it's not contingent upon peace with the Palestinians.
I think that the issue is connected, because I think one of the main ways in which Iran has made inroads into the Arab world is the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And I think that if that was off the table, a lot of the leverage that Iran has been able to exercise by you know, making the case that we are the only ones standing up for the Palestinians would go away. And that would make the task of the Sunni Arab states a lot easier than it is right now.
Okay. Brian, you are often quick to point out, often I think pretty correctly too, that President Trump sometimes uses words that get him into trouble when he doesn't really need to get into trouble. Today in Israel, at several stops, he repeated that, well, maybe it's hard to get these people to make a peace, but, you know, maybe we can do it anyway. I think maybe something's happening here. As a political strategist, would you advise the president to be making such broad, optimistic statements about what is, without question, the toughest challenge of negotiating in the world today?
Look, he's made broad, sweeping promises before. That's why we already have a new wall built on the Mexican border. That's why we already have easily and quickly displaced Obamacare with something better that's terrific and has lowered costs for everybody. And that's why we've gotten these massive tax cuts in place on day one, because he makes these broad promises and then carries through. And the American people are thankful for him carrying through on those promises.
But I just want to add, I mean, one of the things that we should note is that, you know, the region became tired of the Obama administration's efforts in the region. And I think, you know, Trump, by making these broad sweeping statements, which I agree with you, Brian, we've seen success previously.
It works for him. You know? I mean, it works for him.
But I think there is value for the region and sort of the leadership that says, oh, here's somebody who is who is confident in his decisions and believes that he'll be able to make it happen. And for a group of people who are tired on that issue for so many years now, I think it's a new opportunity for them.
Greg, apparently, and did you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I was going to say, and one thing I wanted to add, that the moment that Trump seemed to relish the most about this early visit was his meeting with the Egyptian president, who turned to him and said, you are a unique possibility capable of doing the impossible. And he got really excited.
Yeah, he basically said,
That's right. Well, you know, I think that we need to understand that these people who Trump is dealing with are not naive children. They are, I found it very amusing that the Saudis projected his image on the front of the hotel he was staying in. You know, personally, as an American, I feel insulted that they did that.
Insulted?
Because they obviously think that this person can be manipulated by simple things like projecting his picture on the hotel he's staying in.
Probably a pretty good strategy.
Well, I'm not saying it's a bad strategy. What I'm saying is that, you know, it's like this is how they think of the president.
Greg,
before we move away from this Saudi Arabia thing, I think it's really important that, yes, Trump reached out to the wider Muslim community and hopefully to undo some of the damage that he's been doing over the last 2 years. But he didn't speak about a reset with the American Muslim community, which is virtually under siege because of actions of people who think or who claim to be inspired by his own pronouncements.
Do you have any hope? Are you at all optimistic that as a result of this trip, the president may in fact bring that message back to this country and speak out in a positive way about the American Islamic community?
I have stopped predicting anything about this administration. I think that's the smart thing to do. It could happen. If it did, I think it would do a lot of good to everybody in this country. But
I want to see. I want to say two things on it. One, in all seriousness, I was joking around before.
Really?
But I'm glad. My serious answer is I'm glad to hear the president talking about peace in the Middle East, not going over there being divisive or picking a side, even though I would say most Americans, particularly American Christians, are very pro-Israeli in this debate, and I would put myself in that camp. But number two, when he's talking in these amicable ways with the Muslim world in the Middle East, he's talking to a different audience than he's talking to when he is here talking about domestic policies. And so he's not saying things that are necessarily contradictory. He's just speaking to two different audiences. Mm. And I think to some degree, part of the underlying message is we are very happy to work with y'all while y'all are over here.
Yeah, yeah.
In your homeland.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the deal. I mean, they just signed the arms deal with Saudi Arabia, and that's part of the deal is that, I mean, if by the United States selling all of these armaments, then the United States doesn't necessarily have to fight. They just get to supply and let the Saudis take care of it.
Greg, let's look at the – go ahead.
Also, I think that a lot of Muslims in this country are Americans. They haven't come from over there. You know, they're born here. They grew up here. We are now into a third generation of a very large Muslim community.
Yeah.
Who, you know, your point about as long as you're over there, that's what I'm referring to.
That, yes.
That there is no over there for the American Muslim community. It is over here for them. This is their home.
So. Greg, let's talk just briefly about the optics of all of this. Whenever President Trump seems to give a speech without going off prompter and saying something that ends up making headlines, inevitably some in the media talk about, oh, well, now he's really presidential.
This is the moment.
And I find that fascinating because everything he does is, by definition, presidential. He's the president of the United States. So he did give a speech yesterday that was embraced by a great many people. And our country seems to breathe a sigh of relief that he is capable of doing it. And now we start talking about, oh, well, he'll go on to greater things. It's a really interesting dynamic.
It's already being called, this is the moment when he became the president moment.
Yeah, there you go.
Because you've seen that over and over again. You saw that State of the Union. You saw that his big first address to lawmakers. You saw that just the other day with this speech. And there's a huge portion of the electorate that, whether they like him or don't like him, just want him to be up there and be respectable and be someone they could be proud of.
Yes, but the reality, Dove, is this president, despite how well this trip has gone so far, he's still Donald Trump, and he will come back to the United States and still be Donald Trump, right?
I mean, yes, he'll still be Donald Trump, but maybe, you know, maybe the tenor, maybe something that he's, you know, the way that he's performed abroad. And remember, we're only in day three. I think it's a 9-day trip. I mean, he still has to go tomorrow to Bethlehem. Then he goes to the Vatican. He goes to Rome, the G20. I mean, there's a lot of other aspects to this trip. And, you know, one of the markers of success will be if the entire trip is able to succeed without any major snafu. You know?
Well, it's funny. So he goes from Israel. He goes to the Vatican, visits with the Pope. He's been He fought with the Pope during the campaign. Says some very...
Called the Pope disgraceful.
Called him
a
disgrace.
Refugee status.
You know, he'll be able to get through that visit. But then he goes and meets with NATO leaders, Brian, and I think it's going to be hard to stay on script. It's funny that he is probably being received better and more in a more friendly manner in the Middle East than he's likely to be when he goes to Europe and deals with European leaders.
It's a recurring theme. The images that come to mind are like that really awkward side by side with Angela Merkel, a longtime ally of this country and probably the de facto leader of Europe. I mean, she accomplished peacefully what Hitler tried to do with a war. She just sort of took over the whole continent. And you contrast that with the chumminess that was displayed with Erdogan, who was a dictator who thinks it's okay to come over and beat up American citizens on our streets. And it's a startling contrast. But as far as him going to NATO and there being this awkwardness because he said bad things about NATO in the past, that doesn't bother him.
I mean, no.
He has been at these situations over and over again where he has just blasted somebody publicly and then is with them and acts like they're old friends. I mean, he asked for a standing ovation for Hillary Clinton at his inaugural luncheon after saying that she should be in, you know,
indicted.
She should be indicted. They should call the cops in to cuff her.
Yeah. No, I think that let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe this is a negotiating tactic.
Okay, well, watch
make it. A big stink about NATO not contributing to the budget, and then start your negotiations from that point in time.
So. All right, well,
I agree, and he's right on that.
Yeah.
He's right on that. We shouldn't carry full freight. There are things he says that he's dead on right, and that's one of them.
Okay, Brian Robinson weighs in. Thank you for that. let's bring the conversation back to our shores, Greg. Friday, in the middle of this show, big news stories broke. The first from the New York Times, which reported, I don't remember what the Friday revelation was, but it was...
I'm trying to remember what it was, too. There
which
so
one is Friday?
There was Mueller on Wednesday night.
Yeah. But there was a person of interest.
Oh, well, the Washington Post Washington reports Post? That there's a person of interest. The New York Times reported that he, the Russians...
Job.
Well, go ahead. Called Comey a nut job. Right. Thank you. It's hard to keep these stories straight. This is all still waiting for him when he comes home, yes?
Yeah, and actually, I was just thinking about this as we were talking. There's been a lack of leaks these last few days. So it's almost like everyone got the memo at the same time to stop leaking disparaging stories about President Trump. But they're right back. The investigation's still going on. I expect there to be a lot fewer leaks from the Justice Department now that Mueller is in charge of that investigation. Everyone in Washington seems to say he runs a very tight ship. There won't be that many leaks about the ongoing investigation, but that'll still be going on. It's still going to roil the races here, whether they be the 6th District race or the midterms coming up right around the corner.
Maybe we don't have any leaks because the leaker is on the plane with him.
Maybe.
Well, and of course, that is one.
Which
was
very likely.
That was the Washington Post story that they've got. They've identified someone apparently very close to the president who is under investigation. Over the weekend, we learned, and I was incorrect because I said on Friday I thought that identifying someone as a person of special interest was in fact a legal term. It turns out it's not. I was wrong. It's a term that everybody in the legal and intelligence community said they were a little surprised by because you were either the target or the witness, that sort of thing. So it's a little unclear just what it means that they've identified somebody as a person of special interest. But we'll wait and see how that develops. The point is, in the same way that Richard Nixon went to the Middle East when Watergate was very hot, President Trump is... In the back of his mind, he's got to be thinking, Greg, I've got to. Maybe not. Maybe he's thinking, wow, this is the way I should be treated back home.
And not just the scandals and controversies, but huge policy decisions.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the healthcare debate is still going on. The Senate's still working through that legislation. The tax reform bill he promised. The budget is going to be out this week. I think tomorrow is the draft of the budget. And the healthcare bill will be scored on, I think it's Wednesday.
Yes.
So we have huge domestic news going back, and it's not stopping. It's not waiting for him.
Yeah, Brian, and we did learn that this budget that the Trump administration is finally going to drop is going to have some significant cutbacks in the social safety net for Medicaid particularly, but also for SNAP. For food stamp programs, for CHIP, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program. And whether it'll ever get through Congress in that form, that's once again going to draw attention to the philosophy by which this White House governs.
You know, these original budgets, these first drafts of budgets, are really aspirational in nature and sort of a statement of values. And that's what this is. It is a negotiating tactic. It is a starting out at a very conservative position, hoping that you make progress on spending cuts on some of these very expensive programs. And of course, Medicaid is a major driver of our debt. It is huge. And so I think being able to scale some of that back is important.
Wait. We got to take a break. But before we get, I want to interrupt you. If you right now were running the campaign of a Republican who's going to run for Congress, I get it. This is a negotiating position. You really want your candidate to have to deal with whether there's going to be a huge cut in Medicaid, whether there's going to be a huge cut in the children's health insurance program or food stamps? I mean, in other words, what you're saying is, well, this may never happen, but we'll shift the burden over to Congress and let them take the heat.
Well, in Republican primaries, being against Medicaid is not going to hurt you in any way, because I can't imagine how low the percentage of voters who vote for Republicans are on Medicaid. It's just, it's not the Republicans' constituency. Now, the CHIP program, however, which we here in Georgia know as Peach Care, does reach into the middle class, and it does reach into that the working class white voters who lean toward Republicans in this state. And that is one that would hit Republican voters, and which is a large reason of why there's not going to be any CHIP cuts. It's just not going
to
happen.
All right, we got to take a break, and we also have to say goodbye to you, Syed Rashim Naeem. Why do I struggle with your name?
Naeem. It's very simple.
Naeem. Dr. Naeem. I apologize for that.
No problem.
Come back. We'll talk more about issues, especially in the Islamic community here. We always love having you here.
Thanks
for joining us. And we're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment.
With the nation years into a recovery, food aid is dwindling for hungry people in places like southwestern Virginia.
Used to, my man would go over there, that guy with the hat on there, he might go over and get two pickup truckloads. Now, he went over this morning, got three boxes.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Surplus food and empathy are scarce. Who is caring for America's poor? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
4 till 7 this afternoon here on GPB.
We're back on Political Review. Brian Robinson, Greg Bluestein is a celebrity in Israel.
I was in Israel with Greg a few years ago, and it was, we were late one night. We were walking down this famous street in Jerusalem. It was
Ben Yehuda Street.
And people were stopping Greg and Greg, what are you doing here? And then we were at this office in Tel Aviv, a random office in Tel Aviv, and this woman comes up to him out of her cubicle and goes, "Are you Max Bluestein's brother?" It was the craziest thing. And then we go to the Israeli Museum, and a woman comes up to Greg and goes, "Greg Bluestein, what are you doing here?"
It was actually Gregory Bluestein.
Everywhere we went.
All right. Well, as long as we're talking about silly things, you should tell people what happened to you when you were in South Georgia when a police officer saw you down there.
Yeah. A listener, a fan of your show, and so was familiar with my name. And
heard your name and said, "Are you the Brian Robinson from Political Rewind?
Yeah. All
right, was this at a traffic stop?
All right. I was
in the back seat of the car.
All right. I apologize. There's a lot of important stuff to talk about, so I apologize that we got silly for a second there. Let's talk about the 6th District. For just a minute. I thought it was interesting, Greg. The Political Insider today has a story that says a couple things about Karen Handel. One of them that I thought was interesting, given the timing of the president's visit, was that she announced at a forum the other day that she was all for cutting off government funds to the Palestinian Authority, considering our president, may be meeting with the Palestinian Authority tomorrow. The timing is a little unusual.
Yeah, at a Jewish War Veterans event in Dunwoody on Sunday, she said she would vote. She couldn't wait, actually, to vote for the Taylor Force Act, which is legislation that would defund the Palestinian Authority as long as it continues to give stipends to convicted murderers and terrorists. Now, while that sounds like, as she said, a common sense piece of legislation, Trump administration and Democrats both oppose it because they worry that it would basically stall out any attempts to revive the peace talks.
Dovdi, is there an issue in the 6th District race around Israel of any sort, do you imagine?
Greg is nodding his head. I mean, I think that both candidates are pro-Israel. Both candidates, I know, well, I think there's diverse opinions about that, but I know that both candidates are pro-Israel. So I don't think that that's, I mean, I'm certain for some people that's going to be an issue, but I don't see it as being, it's not a clear talking point that's affecting them from my perspective.
Well, the district is about 8% Jewish. It's one of the more Jewish districts east of the Mississippi, outside of New York, LA, Chicago, LA, you know, the traditionally Jewish hotbeds. So it, Israel, and for a lot of Jewish voters, Israel is, you know, one of the top issues they vote on. So it continues to be any talking point for both candidates. And both candidates, you're right, both candidates are saying, you know, what you'd see as the all the quote-unquote right things about Israel. And John Ossoff himself is Jewish. So I think that there's a lot of broad-based support for it. But
we've got some,
you got some background music going.
Music sneaking into the studio. I'm not quite sure why, but everybody got their phones turned off?
Yeah, I mean,
all right, just go ahead.
And continue with the point about that, this is great music, by the way. you know, I think you are seeing sort of the typical talking points that are the issues from the candidates. You know, and I think one of the things that we have to that we will see is the support that I know John Ossoff has gotten support from J Street. I know they're trying to raise money for him through their PAC.
Go ahead.
You know, my hope, though, is that based on, you know, it's going to be much more on national security than it will be just about Israel, because the Taylor Force Act is a great example. I haven't heard Ossoff talk about that, but
yeah,
I know.
He said he was open to it. He did not pledge his support for the bill, but he said he was receptive to it. Mm. But there are those concerns from Democrats and from Trump's administration that it goes a little too far and that it could threaten whatever hopes they have of this peace talks.
Yeah, well, and I know that it's not necessarily part of the 6th District, but it is one of the changes that we've seen. You know, the Trump administration during the campaign trail was very pro-Israel. I know a lot of people felt that he was going to rubber stamp everything that the Israeli government wants to do. And what you're seeing is a much more traditional outlook towards Israel. I mean, you know, the recognition of the lack thereof, recognition of Jerusalem.
He's not moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem anytime soon, although he said he would during the campaign.
Well, that's right. And one of the things that he could do, by the way, instead of moving the embassies, he could declare the ambassador's residence at the current ambassador to Israel has a home, an apartment in Jerusalem. And if he could actually identify that as the ambassador's residence, that would actually be a major statement for the American government to make. So it's something that, you know, we hope that they would consider, because right now it's a beachfront property. So.
We're also likely to see, and this, I don't know that the candidates in the sixth have weighed in too much on this, Greg, but we're also likely to see some bumping of heads over settlements. Netanyahu has made it clear he has no interest in reducing the number or the breadth of the settlements. And all of a sudden, the Trump administration is advising him that he ought to be thinking about cutting back. Mm-hmm. We'll see if anything comes out of this 2 days in Israel that relates to that. There's language about that.
Yeah, I mean, especially during on the campaign trail, Trump was a staunch defender of the settlement movement. Said he would back up Netanyahu at every turn on the settlement growth. And since then, he has quietly and not so quietly urged Netanyahu to at least slow the growth of settlements, if not freeze them.
All right, let's come back home. Brian, let me get you into this. Greg, you filed this story, but let's give Brian a shot at it first. Brian, Tamar Hallerman and Greg had a piece in The Insider today, saying that Democrats in Georgia think that they may have more targets of opportunity, in congressional races than just that 6th district race. And they cite specifically the 7th district race, which is largely part of Gwinnett County, and that this was, of course, Gwinnett voted for Hillary Clinton. And they're now looking at whether Rob Woodall, the representative up there, the congressman up there, might be vulnerable. Do you think they're dreaming?
They wouldn't be dreaming if the Gwinnett County itself was the district, which I think Rob addressed in his story with Greg. I loved his quote saying, gerrymandering is what's going to keep me in my seat. And I appreciated
that. So do Democrats.
Yeah, I appreciated the frankness of it. The fact is, Woodall only has to get through the 2020 election, and then there'll be a redraw. So if we keep the pattern we have for several decades, we will gain a new seat. Now, perhaps this time, the way that we save Woodall and surrounding congressmen, like, for example, if Karen Handel wins this election, she will presumably stay on and win two more elections after that. They can redraw, put more Republicans into those seats and preserve those two members. But at some juncture, we're going to have so many Democrats, we got to put them somewhere. And so we're down to three. We're down to three Democrat districts in the state now, and what, before Fossoff wins, God forbid. And then, so maybe what we do is that with our new district for the first time, we draw a new Democrat district and move them all out of Woodall's area.
And it's interesting that you make that point right now, because the last headline that I thought we should talk about at least briefly is the Supreme Court of the United States has weighed in on an important redistricting issue to our north in North Carolina, where there's been a battle for quite some time now, a legal battle over the legislature up there having drawn two congressional districts. They said legally, because it is legal to gerrymander on the basis of preserving your party's hold over a district. But, of course, the plaintiffs in the case said, no, they drew these districts around race to isolate African-Americans in districts where they can have their Democrat but won't pollute the Republican district.
And this will be the subtext of all of next year's big statewide races and, of course, the state legislative races in 2020. Whatever party controls the governor's office will have the final say, or at least one of the biggest says, of redistricting. And that's why both Republicans and Democrats are going to pour so many resources into this governor's race.
Well, let me make sure I point out that what the Supreme Court ruled, 5-3, they ruled that North Carolina acted illegally. Clarence Thomas voted with the majority on this. The reason it was 5-3 is that Neil Gorsuch was not yet sitting on the bench when the case was argued, so he didn't take a position in the case. But that's a significant ruling in and of itself, and it's going to force other states to take a look at that kind of racial gerrymandering. But you're right, it's going to be huge in next year's governor's race.
And as we mentioned, the 7th District as well. I mean, you're looking at a district that is most of Gwinnett, but it's also part of South Forsyth, and South Forsyth is so conservative that it's been able to help Rob Woodall to easy election victories year after term after term after term, but it's beginning to change.
Just not going to Walton as well, which is another.
I think there's a snippet of that.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit. All right, look, I'm sorry to call halt to this, but we are completely out of time. By the way, if that was my iPad, someone tried to call me and for some reason triggered music that doesn't play. I don't know quite why that happened, but I try to keep my iPad open so I can see your tweets. And unfortunately, I apologize for that disruption. Dove Wilker, what a pleasure to have you here. Of course, Brian, it's Brian Robinson Monday on Political Rewind, and we like it that
way. Best day of the week.
And Craig Bluestein, we'll see you again really soon. Wednesday, I want to tell you very quickly, Wednesday we're going to be visited once again by Brooke Gladstone, the host of NPR's great, great show on the media. And that's what we're going to focus on. We're going to have a conversation about the latest developments in the relationship between President Trump and the media. I think it should be fascinating. Hank Klibanoff, the former editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and of the Philadelphia Inquirer, will be here as well. So I hope you can join us at 2. And if you can, come on out to the Carter Library, 7 o'clock tomorrow night, for a good conversation about where Atlanta is headed, with a focus on the Beltline particularly. I'm Bill Nigut. See you Wednesday at 2.